Good day and welcome to the EPIC Broadcast, the official podcast of the Parental Rights Foundation. EPIC, E-P-P-C, stands for Empowering Parents, Protecting Children, because that's what we're all about. You can find more episodes on iTunes, Spotify, or on our website at parentalrightsfoundation.org/podcast. Your host today is Parental Rights Foundation President Jim Mason.
Hi, my name is Jim Mason. I'm the president of the Parental Rights Foundation, and joining me today is Emily Gao from the Heritage Foundation. She is the director of the Richard and Helen DeBoss Center for Religion and Civil Society. She's been there for almost 15 years, and she's done a lot of important work surrounding religious freedom and in recent times getting more involved in issues around children and parents as well. Welcome, Emily.
Thank you, Jim.
Emily, why don't you tell our listeners how you got to be who you are today? Just a little background.
Sure. Well, I got interested in religious freedom because I moved from the United States to China when I was 14 years old. And during my time in China in high school with my family, I met pastors from the house churches who had been in prison for their faith. And that was very eye-opening to me, the amount of suffering that they went through because of their government, but also their incredible faithfulness. So that's really what got me interested in human rights. And then went to law school and studied human rights there. And then I worked at the United Nations and later at the State Department and also the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty, and ultimately ended up at the Heritage Foundation. And I'll soon be joining Alliance Defending Freedom, continuing to work on religious freedom and parental rights there.
Well, that's an interesting career. What is it? What is happening today, especially? I mean, we hear a lot of stuff going on all over the place. But what is the biggest issue that you're working on, or threat that you see at the intersection of religious freedom and parental rights?
I think the biggest threat is that the secular progressive ideology of gender theory, also another part of critical theory, which is critical race theory, I think that they are starting to be treated as orthodoxy, not only in the culture, but by the government. And that definitely threatens both religious freedom and parental rights.
What is, gender issue and the critical race issue, they have similarities. What is the critical part of those things? What does that mean? And how does that play out?
Well, you can think of them as two branches of the same tree, the tree being critical theory. And your listeners may already know that, critical theory is a movement that has emerged from academia. It has its roots in cultural Marxism from Europe, from the Frankfurt School. And cultural Marxism is basically taking the Marxist dialectic of class struggle, but instead of applying it to economic classes like, the proletariat and the bourgeoisie, it substitutes identity categories. So race, ethnicity, sex, and more recently, sexual orientation and gender identity. When the Frankfurt School leaders came to the United States, they brought this ideology into academia in the United States. And then later on, postmodernism also sort of merged with some of the ideas of cultural Marxism. And of course, questioning objective truth and our ability to know facts is fundamental to postmodern thought. And all of this now is considered to be critical theory and has come into the mainstream through this wave of identity politics, which is very much a political movement. So that's why we see it today in everywhere from corporations and HR trainings to the federal government to the military and in our public schools.
Just briefly, could you contrast that with the more traditional view that this has begun to supplant?
Well, it certainly supplants the idea that there is such a thing as objective truth that can be known and understood by everybody. It also leads to the subversion of universal human rights, which are, you know, based on the individual. So all of the things that we associate with, you know, our liberal societies, the basis of our rights being equality of all individuals, and then the rights, you know, that we commonly associate with the United States and other liberal societies, like freedom of speech, freedom of religion and conscience, freedom of association, and parental rights. We see all of those things now being undermined by critical theory. So critical theory has not been contained in academia. It's having a very real corrosive effect on our civil society and on our political system.
As one who has watched this emerge, you know, and you watch it carefully from a professional standpoint, when was the tipping point? I mean, I studied critical theory in law school many years ago, as I'm sure you did. Critical theorists have sort of dominated the elite law schools for a longish time, but it didn't seem like it had leaked out into the public consciousness until very recently. What's your take on that?
Well, I think that the events of last summer with the death of George Floyd and the Black Lives Matter movement really propelled some of this ideology into the, you know, into the mainstream. I think that many of the movements that we see, the Black Lives Matter movement, to some extent Antifa, they are implementing really the ideology of critical theory, critical race theory, the idea that, you know, America is a fundamentally racist country, that, you know, we should identify based on our membership in particular groups, whether that be, you know, our racial or ethnic identity or sex, sexual orientation, gender identity. I mean, these are the ideas that are core to the Black Lives Matter movement. Not only that we should identify according to race and ethnicity, but, you know, your listeners probably know Black Lives Matter also embraces transgenderism. These are some of the ideas that are really being implemented by these political movements. But I think there's probably also a more low-key trend that is not as clear-cut to most people as the Black Lives Matter movement, and that is the diversity, equity, and inclusion movement that has been, you know, slower and more subtle, but it is taking over, again, corporations, the federal government, military, and our schools. And that also is based on the same principles that, you know, we should not focus on our identity as individuals and things that are, you know, the content of our character, but our primary identity comes from our membership in these different groups that are, you know, either considered to be oppressed or oppressor groups. And that this idea that, you know, minorities, whether it's racial minorities or what they consider to be sexual minorities, are victims, and this need to sort of overturn the existing, what they consider to be structure of oppressed and oppressor. All those ideas stem from the critical theory that you and I encountered in academia.
So these things are emerging in a real world way and in a highly publicized way, especially in public schools. Have you been following those reports lately?
Yes, well, these issues have been happening in public schools for a while, but I think this summer they've really come to the fore as parents, you know, during the COVID lockdowns, they were able to see really what their children are being taught in school curriculum. And, you know, most parents don't want their child being told what they can't be rather than what they can be. And critical race theory very much does that to children of all ethnic backgrounds. It tells, you know, children who are minorities, that you really can never be equal to students who are, you know, white, because you'll always be a victim, you'll always be oppressed in the eyes of the majority. Similarly, you know, critical race theory tells students who are white that they'll always be oppressors, that they'll always be part of this systemic injustice, that no matter what they may think or do, they will always have this stain of collective guilt. So I think parents are, you know, speaking out all over the country at school board meetings about critical race theory. I think the pushback on gender theory is happening as well, but again, that's been sort of more long-term and more subtle. There hasn't been a really catalyzing incident, but on gender theory, you know, people are speaking out about drag queen story hours at public libraries and in public schools. There have been protests at a number of school boards when children are being read books on transgenderism, like I Am Jazz, that, you know, tells a five-year-old you might be trapped in the wrong body and you could transition from being a boy to a girl or vice versa. And I think a lot of parents are just very upset with how sexual and really pornographic in some cases the curriculum has become. We've seen parents expressing outrage at school board meetings over just how sexualized curriculum has become. And it's not only in sex ed, it's all throughout the curriculum. It's in English class. And we also see politicization of history, the way history is taught. Now children are taught that historical figures like President James Buchanan or Sally Ride, the astronaut, children are being taught about their supposed sexual orientation.
So you wrote an article about 3 weeks ago about the 60 Minutes episode on transgender movement. And your article was called, We'll Tell You What 60 Minutes Won't, about how transgender movement endangers kids. Tell us a little bit more about how the transgender movement is endangering kids, and it's especially with its intersection with the right of parents to be involved in the decisions of their children.
Yes, well, 60 Minutes, to their credit, they reached out to the Heritage Foundation because of our involvement in the Promise to America's Children. And that is a movement that was launched in February with two other public policy organizations, Alliance Defending Freedom and the Family Policy Alliance. And that is a statement of 10 principles to protect children from gender ideology by protecting their minds, their bodies, and their relationships with their parents. And it was specifically rolled out to show the harms of the Equality Act to children and to their parents. But it's also been associated with a lot of good legislation that has been enacted or introduced in the states, like the SAFE Act, which is a Saving Adolescents from Experimentation Act in Arkansas that bans the use of experimental puberty blockers and cross-sex hormones and surgeries on children for the treatment of gender dysphoria. So the Promise to America's Children has been signed by thousands of parents, 60 public policy organizations, and members of Congress, and then state lawmakers. So a state lawmaker in Arkansas, Robin Lundstrom, she introduced the SAFE Act. And the SAFE Act, after being vetoed by Governor Asa Hutchinson, that veto was overridden and it passed in Arkansas. So it became law. So it was the first law in the country to ban these interventions on children's bodies. And it has garnered quite a bit of attention. And that is why 60 Minutes did the special episode about the SAFE Act. And they reached out to the Heritage Foundation for comment because of our involvement in the Promise to America's Children. But as we'll discuss, we were very dismayed at how one-sided 60 Minutes Plus coverage was of the SAFE Act.
What's the other side?
The other side is the parents who want their children who are struggling with gender dysphoria to receive counseling and go through a period of watchful waiting before they are rushed into gender transition with hormones or even surgeries. The other side is also the young people who have gone through these interventions on their bodies who now deeply regret them and are even suing to try and stop these types of interventions on children's bodies. And their voices were not covered in the 60 Minutes Plus piece. They also really didn't cover the doctors and counselors who question, you know, whether these are the right treatments for children, whether these are ethical or helpful to children. There's a growing number of doctors around the world who actually, you know, believe that these interventions are harmful to children, and they were not covered at all.
So how did this ideology kind of take over the cultural heights to where, I mean, I'm actually sitting here interviewing you and you sound very reasonable and rational, and I can't find any, you know, major area of disagreement with what you're saying. But, you know, I am also aware that, you know, this podcast could get released and we could be subject to a tweet storm of accusation about how our views are not just incorrect, but bigoted and, you know, worthy of being canceled from all good company. How did that happen? And what do we do about it?
I think you're right to ask how these really radical ideas captured the heights of culture, because that is exactly what happened. Basically, the gatekeeping organizations of our medical profession have all gone in on transgender ideology. So the American Medical Association, American Psychiatric Association, American Academy of Pediatrics, they've all embraced this idea that the best way to treat a child's mental distress is to cosmetically alter their bodies. And this is such a radical concept. We would never do this with any other body dysmorphia like anorexia or bulimia. That would be unthinkable. So it really does come down to politics. And this is something that is openly admitted by the LGBT community. There's a book by an author called Jason Pearson, Sexual Minorities and Politics. He's a pro-LGBT author. And he basically says that, you know, through the lobbying of the LGBT community, through groups like the Human Rights Campaign, they managed to pressure the American Psychiatric Association to change the designation of gender dysphoria. It used to be called gender identity disorder. Now it's called gender dysphoria. It was treated as a mental illness in the DSM-5. Now it's only treated as, only the stress that comes from gender dysphoria is treated as a mental illness. And in his book, he basically says this is due to, you know, our successful political campaigning that changed this designation in a manual for doctors. So there's a lot of political power. There's a lot of money behind the transgender movement. There's an organization called WPATH, it's World Professional Association for Transgender Health. That organization is not actually a medical organization, although a lot of journalists would describe it that way. It's actually just an organization of people who support transgender ideology from all different fields. They've had an incredible influence on the professional associations, the gatekeepers. And so even though there's not a single study that shows that these gender affirmation treatments are healthy for adults, much less children, all of these gatekeeping organizations have bought into it.
Yeah, so the, before the kind of explosion, we were talking a lot about how in the early days of, you know, pre-explosion, there was a lot of peer pressure for especially children in school That's not the word. What's the word that where children are influenced by their peers to
social contagion?
Yeah. There you go. I was coming up with moral panic, but that wasn't the right word. I knew that. So this sort of social contagion idea has led to there are a lot of so. One thing we need to, I just want to express, and I'm sure you agree with this, children who are genuinely distressed need to be treated sympathetically and with care, and their parents should be the ones primarily helping them through these times. But then there is this other outer band of children who are affected by the social contagion component of it. And that presents a whole raft of problems, I think. Talk about that a little bit. I mean, additional problems.
Sure. I mean, there's been such a sharp increase in the number of children who now struggle with their gender identity. This is documented in detail, both in Abigail Schreier's book, Irreversible Damage, and also in a study from Brown University from a medical researcher named Lisa Lippman, who coined the phrase rapid onset gender dysphoria. And I mean, the number of high school students who now identify as transgender is 1 in 50. Just 10 years ago, it was under 1% of adults. And now it's 2% of teenagers. So this is a very sharp increase. And we have to ask, you know, why is this happening? And that's exactly what Lisa Lippman did in her study. She found, basically, after interviewing a number of parents and young people, that it was very much influenced by social contagion, that it was when a student, you know, particularly a girl, would see her friends or her teacher or a coach start to identify as transgender, then suddenly that would become very popular among a group of girls. So that's why we see now clusters of young girls or sometimes boys who identify as transgender. We've also seen this mushrooming of gender clinics around the country. I believe there's over 60 gender clinics now. And of course, these clinics are tremendously profitable because if you can put a child onto hormones, you know, when they're not even an adult, you will keep them on hormones for their entire life. And then potentially surgeries as well. So some of these clinics, we are hearing stories that, you know, 100% of the children who are brought to these clinics are diagnosed as having gender dysphoria. That's what happened in Cincinnati, which is a really interesting parental rights case that we can talk about. But what's really important to understand about the rise of gender dysphoria in American children is that there's a huge social element that comes from social media, comes from our culture, also I think comes from the indoctrination in curriculum and school policies, as well as what they see from their peers and influential adults in their life.
You mentioned something earlier that I think is really important to understand in this moment in history, and that is that a lot of this was sort of happening in public schools where people like you and I who pay attention were sort of aware of it, but the average parent out in the suburbs may not have been. And that is with the coronavirus epidemic, lots of parents became more closely aware of what was happening in their schools and what their children were being taught. Is this a moment in history that offers opportunities to roll back some of this, or is it unstoppable?
I think it is a pivotal moment in history. We've seen more parents, you know, speaking up at school board meetings and supporting good legislation and opposing bad legislation than I think any time probably since the Common Core controversies. Parents are having their eyes open across the country, and we're just seeing tremendous activism from parents that, you know, they can't you know, they can't allow their children to be indoctrinated into these ideas that are harmful in so many ways, harmful to their minds, with gender theory, harmful to their bodies, and then ultimately with the transgender movement and what they want to do to parents, it ultimately can harm the relationship between children and their own parents.
Talk about that some more. How does it harm the relationship?
So, I mean, we hear from so many parents that, you know, when their child is influenced by the culture, by their schools, by their peers to identify as transgender, that the children just take a very, you know, radical position, and then they become extremely hostile to anyone who opposes the idea of gender transition. A lot of these children already have coexisting conditions, think like autism or other issues like anxiety and depression, and they really become sucked into the transgender movement. A lot of parents have described it as a cult. So there's a lot of friction between parents and kids just in the family dynamic when transgender ideology seduces children. But then when it gets to the school context or the medical context, we really see that teachers and administrators and medical professionals are treating parents as the enemy if they won't affirm the idea that, you know, a child can change sex, which of course a child cannot change sex. No one can change sex. So with the school context, we see that administrators and teachers are adopting and implementing policies to counsel children towards sex change and keeping parents in the dark. So they will have separate files for a child that they won't show to their parents. They will start to socially transition a child at school, giving them a different name, using different pronouns, even dressing them, allowing them to dress in different clothing than what they wore to school. And then they will invite children into counseling sessions with even school counselors that will, you know, affirm gender identity. And there's a lawsuit with the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty and Alliance Defending Freedom right now in Madison, where the school actually had all of these policies in writing. And when the parents found out about it, they sued their school district. But a lot of these school districts probably have similar policies, but haven't put them in writing, because we hear stories like this from all over the country. And then it becomes even more dire when children are entered into the medical system, because as I said, so many of these gender clinics, they really see this as a one-way street towards gender affirmation. And they don't do thorough counseling with children to see what the underlying causes of gender dysphoria may be. Instead, they rush children onto hormones. And if the parents don't agree with gender affirmation, they will be treated as the enemy, both by doctors and definitely by the transgender activists. And we've seen a few cases in which parents have either been threatened with losing custody of their children, or they've actually lost custody of their children. And the courts tend to defer to the recommendations of the doctors, and sometimes the child and family services officials who largely support gender affirmation.
You mentioned a Cincinnati case. What's that about?
So that is a really tragic case. There was a girl who was 16 years old when she began to struggle with feelings of gender dysphoria. Her parents took her to the Cincinnati Children's Hospital, to the gender clinic there. And she was immediately diagnosed with gender dysphoria. And that's one of the clinics where 100% of kids are diagnosed with gender dysphoria. They recommended that she start taking testosterone. The parents wanted her to go through counseling and not onto testosterone, but the Child and Family Services got involved. They also supported the gender transition. And so ultimately the case ended up in a family court, and the judge in that case did exactly what I just described. She looked at the recommendations from the Cincinnati Children's Clinic, the doctors there, and Child and Family Services, And she ended up transferring custody of the minor to the grandparents, who would affirm her taking testosterone.
So a traditional view of how that works, and I do a fair amount of work in the courts regarding, you know, child protective services on other issues. But the traditional view would be that first, the parents would have to have been proven to have caused harm to a child, that such that judicial intervention is necessary. Now, the Cincinnati case, was that the finding, that the parents' decision was tantamount to child abuse, such that the court could order the child to go someplace, you know, to live with the grandparents?
I'm not sure that the court adopted that finding, but that is certainly what the transgender activists involved in that case have been saying. And that's what transgender activists around the country and around the world are saying. They're saying that it is in the best interest of a child who struggles with gender dysphoria to go through gender affirmation. And they will often say that if you don't allow the child to go on to hormones and eventually onto surgeries, that you will be risking that child's life because it will increase the likelihood of suicide. Now, of course, there is absolutely no evidence that that is the case. In fact, the best study of adults from Sweden shows that suicidal ideation increased after gender transition. So it's a totally unfounded argument, but parents are threatened with it all the time. They're asked, you know, do you want a live, you know, son, or do you want a dead daughter? It's blackmail, but it is being thrown around by transgender activists all the time. And I've seen articles in the professional journals from transgender, you know, affirming doctors and researchers who argue that it isn't the best interest of the child with gender dysphoria to go through gender affirmation, and that parents who oppose it are not acting in the best interest of the child. So I think it's probably a pretty short line between making those arguments in academic journals and, you know, making them in court. And hopefully courts will not accept that, but that's definitely, I think, the trajectory of where the transgender activists are going.
So the traditional role of parents and minor children has been to, you know, they have a high duty and obligation to raise, nurture, and educate their children and look after their medical well-being. That's being directly eroded, both in the legal sense, like the Cincinnati case, but also in a societal sense, where these institutions have kind of sold out to those ideologies. What do we do about it?
Well, I think the first thing is education. So learning what is happening, learning how children are being indoctrinated is really the first line of defense for parents. Understanding what is happening in the schools. And it's not only curriculum, it's policies. It's policies like, you know, during Pride Month, children being asked to, you know, wear a t-shirt that celebrates Pride Month, or to, you know, salute the pride flag. And I mean that, you know, metaphorically. I think there are, you know, all of these orders from the Biden administration. There was the executive order on transgender bathrooms and locker rooms and sports. You know, 21 attorney generals are pushing back on that. I think, you know, providing support for those who are opposing transgender ideology, the governors, the attorney generals, the lawmakers who are trying to stop the Biden administration from rapidly, you know, ushering these policies into schools just through administrative power. I think the PromiseToAmericasChildren.org is a good place to start to learn about what the policies are. Then I also think the Gender Resource Guide, that's a free guide online, Gender Resource Guide. It's a very useful manual for parents that introduces them to what's happening in our law and our culture, and it gives them really practical steps. It gives them, you know, letters that they can write to their school board or to the school saying, I don't want my child to be participating in these activities or in this curriculum. I want to opt in my child. I don't want there just to be, you know, an opt-out provision. And then I think, you know, just we just need the silent majority to become a vocal majority, whether that is at a school board meeting or supporting a state law or opposing a bad federal law like the Equality Act that would have added, you know, gender identity to the 1964 Civil Rights Act and had a radical transformative effect on schools across the nation implementing gender identity policies and gender identity curriculum.
I sent you an article about a lawsuit that I recently filed. Did you get a chance to look at that? Let me just give you a couple of sentences about it. This started last year. DC, the city council, introduced a bill that said children as young as 11 could consent to vaccinations, childhood vaccinations, without their parents' knowledge or consent. And in fact, the law set it up so that even the parents' insurance companies could not inform the parents that they had vaccinated in the explanation of benefits. The schools, public schools in DC, keep double books, one set that's available to the parents and one that's available to the school. And only, you know, the one available to the school shows that the child had received these vaccinations. So of course that became a bigger issue once the coronavirus vaccine became available. And so my organization and others tried to persuade the DC Council to vote against it. It was eventually voted 10 to 3. We got two additional councilmen who came around to seeing that it's not really a good idea to hide medical treatments from parents. And then the DC ordinances must be approved by Congress. Congress has a chance to veto DC ordinances, and Congress, we got bills introduced, but it didn't take off, went into effect. And so we filed a lawsuit basically on parental rights grounds and others, but primarily parental rights grounds that says that, you know, parents should be involved in the medical decision-making of their children. And these vaccines, you can be exempt from them and attend the public school under the ordinance. But then you can send your children to the public schools and the medical clinic at the schools can give them the vaccine nevertheless and hide it from you. The one of the council members who was quoted in the newspaper this week said, the child has his or her own agency in their body and their health and their lives, and that the law has a safeguard because the medical provider can't give the vaccine unless a child as young as 11 years old, unless the medical provider determines they're able to make informed consent. So, you know, the critical race theory and transgender ideology are in the news a lot, but this is all of the same piece where public officials are taking parents out of the equation, where they're traditionally, you know, it has long been understood traditionally that parents should be the ones making these decisions. Do you think that 11-year-old children should be allowed to make informed consent for medical procedures, even, you know, routine childhood vaccines?
Of course not. We have different laws for adults and children in so many contexts in order to protect the health, the safety, and well-being of children. I mean, that's why we have, you know, laws on when a child has to be in a car seat or when a child, you know, is able to get a tattoo or a piercing or, you know, drink alcohol or drive a car or, you know, even buy cough syrup. And to undermine the role of parents in making decisions regarding the medical treatment of a child, it's just incredible that this is happening. And it is happening in the context of the gender affirmation too. In states like Oregon, a 15-year-old can get surgery without the parents consenting. And in Washington and California, they've also, you know, allowed teenagers to get hormones and surgeries without parental consent. And we heard this horror story at the UCLA gender clinic that 13-year-old girls are getting double mastectomies. All of this needs to be understood in the light of the recent ruling in the United Kingdom in the Kira Bell versus Tavistock case that a 16-year-old cannot give informed consent to hormones or surgeries because they don't have a fully developed mental and emotional capacity to make a decision that could alter their lives, that could, you know, make them permanently sterile. So that case was brought by this young woman named Kira Bell, who's now in her early 20s. And she was struggling with gender dysphoria. She went to this Tavistock gender clinic. And in a very short amount of time, they recommended that she go into puberty blockers when she was just a teenager. And she did, and ended up having a double mastectomy. She now is, you know, her life is, her body's been permanently changed. She has, her voice has been lowered. She has facial hair. She's, you know, her breasts have been removed, and now she's worried that she may be sterilized for life. So, I mean, these cases are tragic and totally avoidable. This should never have happened to her. And there's a growing number of young women and young men who are also detransitioning, who also are asking why adults did not stop them from going through these interventions that have, you know, changed their lives forever. We should never be allowing children to make decisions that could lead to their permanent sterilization.
Yeah, interesting times. Interesting times. Well, I'm glad you're out there working on these issues. And tell us a little bit about what you'll be doing at the Alliance Defending Freedom starting next month.
Well, I'm very excited to join Alliance Defending Freedom because they are on the front lines of many of these issues that you and I have been discussing today, parental rights and religious freedom. So I'll continue to work on these issues that we've talked about, gender theory and critical race theory, very much focusing on cultural engagement, trying to influence the culture and help people understand what is going on in the courts and understand the legislation. And as you know, Alliance Defending Freedom has litigated at every level after the Supreme Court and has also been instrumental in state and federal legislation. So the work that I do on cultural engagement will be in support of all of ADF's work on litigation and legislation.
So is it safe to say part of your job is kind of winning back the hearts and minds of folks around the country to come back to their senses a little bit?
Very much so. And I think that there is a lot of hope in this area, actually, because what we see is bipartisan concern from parents on all sides of, you know, the political spectrum. This is an area, especially with gender theory, that unites parents on the left and the right. And with critical race theory, we see parents from, you know, all different ethnic backgrounds, socioeconomic backgrounds, recognizing that this is not helping children, this is harming children. And so I'm very hopeful that we will be able to build some very strong bipartisan alliances with people who may not agree with us on everything, but who we all see the common threat that this presents to children.
Yeah, I think that's a really important part of this, that the, you know, that while these ideologies have sort of taken off like a prairie fire, and you know, but we should be brave and courageous to speak out and to band together and understand that it's not monolithic. I mean, there are people from all backgrounds and political persuasions who are very concerned about these sort of things. I see it all the time in the parental rights work that I do. It's kind of not, you know, at the grassroots level, it's not ideological in the sense of left, right, or Republican, Democrat. Everybody loves their kids, you know, I mean, all parents love their kids, and they don't want these interventions without their knowledge or consent to sort of take over. Any final thoughts, final words? You've been very generous with your time. I'll give you the last word.
Well, one thing your listeners should know is that, you know, the majority of Americans don't support these radical ideologies being really indoctrinated in public schools. So the Heritage Foundation did a nationwide survey last year of both parents and school boards. And the majority of parents don't want their children to be taught, you know, that a child could be trapped in the wrong body. They don't want their children to be taught that, you know, America was is a fundamentally racist country. Instead, they want children to be taught things like the value of marriage and family formation, what we call the success sequence, you know, that if you finish high school, get a job, get married, and have children in that order, you have a 98% chance of, you know, staying out of poverty. They want children to be taught character and values. So the majority recognizes that the best policies for children to help them flourish involve, you know, marriage and family formation and instilling the values that, you know, America stands for, equality and individual rights. But there is a threat of cancel culture, and I recognize that that is very intimidating. So I would just agree with what you said, that it's a time that is very challenging, but it's a time for courage, because children are our future and they cannot speak up for themselves in so many of these cases. And so we really need to speak up on their behalf.
Well, thank you. My guest is Emily Gao of the Heritage Foundation, soon to be with Alliance Defending Freedom. Thank you again for your time. And I'm Jim Mason, president of the Parental Rights Foundation. If you'd like to support our work, you can go to our webpage at parentalrightsfoundation.org and sign up for our emails or make a donation to help us with our work, including the DC case that we just filed a couple of weeks ago. So thanks again, Emily.
Thank you.
You have been listening to the EPIC Broadcast, the official podcast of the Parental Rights Foundation. You can find this and all our episodes at parentalrightsfoundation.org/podcast or on iTunes or Spotify. If you enjoyed this episode, please share our podcast with your friends, use the EPIC hashtag with two P's on social media, or leave a review on Apple Podcasts to help others join our community. The Parental Rights Foundation is a donor-supported 501c3 dedicated to protecting children by empowering parents. To support our work, including this podcast, make a gift today at parentalrightsfoundation.org. Thank you for listening.